Well, how about Greek? We have the New Testament written in Greek. What led to that? I mean, why not some other language? Why didn't Hebrew continue to be the main language?
Well, I think mainly it's due to its general inferiority to the Greek language, or at least that's what I would tend to want to say if my Old Testament colleagues weren't around.
Welcome back to Roundtable, episode 21. I'm Jared Luchibor. We're launching into a new three-part series on biblical studies here at Mid-America Reform Seminary. We thought we'd take some time to discuss what it means to do biblical scholarship and what it means to teach biblical studies in a seminary. And we thought we'd start with just even a discussion on the biblical languages. Mid-America is one of the seminaries which are getting fewer and fewer as time goes by that have a rigorous commitment to and requirement of the biblical languages. Mid-America not only has classes strictly in Hebrew and Koine Greek, but even during their time in exegesis classes, Old Testament and New, students are thoroughly engaged in the biblical languages as they weave their way through the biblical text in their time of learning. Taking part in this discussion in speaking order are Associate Professor of Old Testament, Reverend Mark Vanderhart, Assistant Professor of Old Testament, Reverend Andrew Compton, and Associate Professor of New Testament, Dr. Marcus Minninger. They start with a basic question. In what languages was the Bible written?
Well, the Bible was written in ancient Hebrew, and Hebrew is simply a dialect of Semitic languages that was found in Palestine, in Canaan. And the New Testament was written in Greek, but not classical Attic Greek. It was written in Koine Greek. And portions of the Old Testament, sections in Ezra and Daniel particularly, were written in ancient Aramaic, another Semitic language. Mm-hmm. Now, just to elaborate on what Professor Compton said, I remember meeting at Princeton Seminary students who were taking either summer Greek or summer Hebrew.
Either one,
and they were graduates already of Princeton Seminary. And when I asked them the question, well, why are you taking one of those languages now? They said, well, Princeton requires knowledge of one of the original languages, either Hebrew or Greek. They don't require a knowledge of both. But the presbyteries back then required a knowledge of both. Hmm. And so having graduated with their seminary degree, they were now coming back to study the language, the other language, so that they might meet a presbytery requirement. And so when I asked them, oh, you are only taking Hebrew now, in your exegesis courses, how did you exegete the text? And they looked at me and they said, from English Bible, of course. And the conversation then went in a different direction, but I thought, oh my. Wow. The knowledge of both languages is so important for the reading of the text.
Yeah, it really goes into being able to more effectively explain the meaning of a text. Even if you use a particular English translation in your churches, there's still a need to be able to illustrate what that English translation is trying to capture. And how do you even do that without knowledge of both of these biblical languages? Now, we typically, most seminaries don't spend as much time on Aramaic. Often they don't have a specific class, although we have Mid-America at times offered Aramaic, and you've had over the years students come in and do that. Seems like a lot of times students will, once they're grounded in Hebrew, be able to learn a degree of how Aramaic relates. You did mention that they're both Semitic languages. There's a whole family of languages related to Hebrew and Aramaic. Some of them people may be more aware of than others. There's Akkadian that some people have heard of ancient texts being written in, ancient flood stories, ancient accounts, ancient kings lists. There's, even Arabic is a Semitic language. Most people know of Arabic, but don't realize how old that language truly is. But there's a whole range of them, which allows Hebrew and Aramaic to kind of be situated. But it means that if you've got a good grounding in Hebrew, you can from there begin to learn to work in Aramaic. Most people don't learn it the other way around.
One of my professors said, once you learn one Semitic language, the other 69 come fairly easily. The scripts may differ, but the basic structure of Semitic languages is the same.
Well, how about Greek? We have the New Testament written in Greek. What led to that? I mean, why not some other language? Why didn't Hebrew continue to be the main language?
Well, I think mainly it's due to its general inferiority to the Greek language, or at least that's what I would tend to want to say if my Old Testament colleagues weren't around. In terms of just basic ancient history, the conquering of the western part of the Mediterranean and much else by Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC, of course, led to a process of the distribution of the spreading of Greek culture, but also Greek language throughout the whole Mediterranean basin, really. And that continued to be the case. Even it was the most dominant language, the most common language, the lingua franca, as they sometimes say, even after the ascendancy of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. So that's the language that the New Testament authors write in, even when Paul writes to Rome, or even when he writes to a Roman colony like Philippi, where Latin may have been more common in many respects, the more native language, especially in Rome, he still writes in Greek. So it's part of the legacy of Alexander the Great.
Now, the New Testament's generally in a more of a Koine Greek, as opposed to an Attic, as Professor Vanderhart was just saying. But was there a prestige element even to writing in Greek? Would that have informed writing in that rather than Latin, even if there were those knowing and reading Latin in certain areas?
Yeah, well, so the distinction between Attic and Koine, if you go back and you read Plato, Aristotle, you'll see a somewhat more complex language. Hmm. It's something that graduate students do maybe we don't typically have that done here, but graduate students in, say, a PhD program, I had to read Plato's Apology of Socrates in Greek in my doctoral work, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly a significant step up. There was a day and age in which classicists, those who study the classical period of ancient Greece, those who are also Christians, were a little concerned about why the New Testament's Greek looks so different, and tried to make the explanation that it was a special kind of Greek. It was called the Holy Spirit Greek, that was kind of divinely given, but it was really sort of an effort to deal with the fact of why is this so much simpler. But Koine means common. It is the common Greek of the 1st century AD and the surrounding period of time. So it's the same basic Greek that you would see being written by Josephus, by Philo, first century Jews, that you would see in letters that are being written in the time period, say a soldier writing home to his mother, etc. We have various ancient letters. We can see the similarity. So it's really the Greek of the time period and can be studied profitably alongside other contemporaneous literature.
And also the fact that the apostles John, or especially Paul, are writing to a variety of churches throughout the eastern part of the Mediterranean. Even the Jewish communities in Asia Minor and Greece, etc., were probably more literate in the Greek language than they would have been in Hebrew or Aramaic. And therefore, since you have Gentile believers as well as Greek-speaking, Greek-reading Jewish people, it only makes sense that to reach the best, the greatest audience, you would write in Greek.
It's interesting. People tend to think even of Hebrew as a very monolithic language, and yet it's fascinating that even linguists who study the Hebrew that we find in the Bible have begun to note that there's quite a range of Hebrew. There's some of the earliest material, generally some of the poetic portions like the Song of the Sea in Exodus 15 or the Song of Deborah, you know, are thought to contain a very early form, a real pared-down kind of Greek, Hebrew, I'm sorry. And then more of the prose reflects a more classic period. They'll sometimes differentiate archaic biblical Hebrew from classical biblical Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And then even books like Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah begin to shift into a type of Hebrew that reads a lot more like the Mishnah will read or the Talmuds will read, a late biblical Hebrew. And so there's even distinction within the Old Testament based on its relative age of writing. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, kind of even thinking about geography, scholars have begun to notice that there's particular kinds of dialectical differences between texts and books that are sort of aimed at the northern kingdom. Think of a book like Hosea, you know, where he's bringing a message to Samaria, which is different from books that seemed more focused on Jerusalem. And a number of scholars have sought to understand even a linguistic variation. And it's been remarkable how many Hebrew texts have been found by archaeologists, usually written on pieces of pottery or written on walls or things like that as decoration, and yet these things have enabled them to start positing what they sometimes call isoglosses or kind of dialects. It's kind of like the fact that when I came from California, we would call every carbonated beverage a Coke, and now here in Chicagoland, every carbonated beverage is called a pop. Well, it's a linguistic isogloss. It's the same kind of thing going on, and we can find similar things in Hebrew. So it just goes to show that there's a lot to know about these languages. And yet, for the pastor who's tasked not chiefly with trying to understand linguistic isoglosses of Northern Hebrew versus Southern Hebrew or classical Attic Greek versus a Koine Greek or what have you, you know, how are the languages beneficial? What are some concrete ways that we even teach men here to use the languages in their pastoral work that they're preparing for?
Well, I would say, just to begin to answer your question, it's a great question, that since Biblical Greek, Biblical Hebrew is not the mother tongue of any of our students, that
it's a shame, but yeah.
A shame, but we got to face reality.
Yeah, I know.
That in learning these languages, your goal would, or you would hope that they would become very, very proficient in it, but realistically, they acquire a reading knowledge, I should hope, in which they're able, minimally, to follow the discussion of a sound and good exegetical commentary. Mm-hmm. They can follow mm-hmm. the argument. They know what's being said, and they can agree or not agree or benefit from that. Mm-hmm. But I sometimes liken reading a biblical language to walking on a rock with bare feet. You feel every stone.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in reading Biblical Hebrew, Biblical Greek, you're forced to give attention to the words. Now, you don't isolate those words. You read in context. You read sentences and paragraphs together. But it forces you to listen to this word and to reflect upon its meaning, always in context. Whereas in English, the mother tongue of most of our students, the temptation, if it's a temptation, or the practice of it is, you read quickly over the English words. And again, that's a translation. You're not hearing the original. And therefore, sometimes the nuances of the original can be lost.
Yeah, I had a professor talk about the languages force us to slow down in our reading.
Yeah, and I think they also force us to remember that God is pleased to give scriptures that emerge out of and are produced in different contexts, even different contexts that are than our own. We talk a lot in biblical department about the organic nature of inspiration, organic inspiration, that God didn't drop the Bible down from heaven unmediated through human authors and didn't just dictate the Bible to human authors, but he worked through their thoughts and feelings and experiences mm-hmm. and native vocabulary, et cetera. Yeah. And so the biblical languages are kind of a start to that in some ways, where you start to say, I need to seek to learn somebody else's language in order to listen to them most attentively and accurately. Really, every translation that you pick up, and we are privileged to have many wonderful translations in the English language that you can really benefit from. People in the pew benefit from those very, very well. And yet, every one of those translations into any other language is also an interpretation.
Right.
And to get more up close and personal with what was really said, word for word, blow by blow, you need to look at it in the original. So I think that's a significant part of it. We want students to be able to translate each passage that they work with in an exegetical paper. And as Professor Vanderhart said, to also really understand and make discerning use of the commentaries and other resources that they use as they study texts. Don't just, you know, believe what every commentary says. First of mm-hmm. all, they contradict each other. They disagree. So you have to learn to have discernment there. And of course, a big part of that is knowing the nuts and bolts and the rules of grammar and syntax in the language.
It's even interesting to sometimes come across discussions and commentaries, and somebody will make some claim about a particular grammatical point, and they end up citing something of like an intermediate or student grammar. And it's very interesting if you're not sort of aware of even grammatical discussions, how grammar is studied in the languages. Then you could read that, well, some Bible scholar in a published commentary says X, this must be the case. But again, knowing it enables us to ask even a further question. Well, why are they citing that? And why not a more academic Hebrew grammar or Greek grammar? Mm-hmm.
Certainly sometimes people come and they have this sense of, well, why can't we just use all the powerful software tools that are out there now? Mm-hmm. You know, used to be BibleWorks. Now that's become defunct, I guess. I still use it for now, but mm-hmm. Others, Accordance, et cetera, Bible software programs, Logos. There's a few reasons why you can't simply use those. They're great tools for certain things. But one of the reasons is that it can tell you with a high degree of accuracy how to parse a word. You know, is this a present tense verb or a future tense or aorist tense? But even there, sometimes there's a potential for disagreement and discussion, but generally they're quite good at that, but they won't tell you why is that significant. And then beyond that, it certainly won't tell you that every present tense or future or aorist tense verb could do a lot of different things in
yeah.
Greek. And well, which one is it? There's a whole range of different things that each tense can do. And then you talk about each case in terms of nouns, in other parts of speech, participles, et cetera, mm-hmm. It becomes somewhat complex. And of course, that's the beauty of the language. In part, it's nuances, but you can't go to a Bible software program and say, which use of the participle is this? Tell right. me indisputably. Mm-hmm. They can give you their opinion, mm-hmm. But really at that point is an interpretive opinion and not a mere objective piece of data, so to speak. And so you have to learn to delve into the intermediate grammar. We spend quite a bit of time at Mid-America on that. And then we also continue to test students in the original languages during their exegetical classes. Every yeah. time you take an exegesis class in Old Testament, you'll also have a Hebrew test that yeah. You're supposed to translate and be prepared to translate and answer questions about some passage, selection of text from what that course is covering, and then the same thing in for Greek on the New Testament side, so that we can continue to sharpen those tools. And then we seek to integrate that into lecture and discussion, of course, exegetical papers, even for it to inform sermons. We don't encourage students to be citing Hebrew and Greek directly in sermons on usually ever, but certainly not on any regular basis, but that they should know it themselves, and it, and decisions about it should be percolating into why they preach the way they preach and with the emphases that they preach. And I might just mention, while we're on that topic, I think one of the real neat things about our curriculum is that we always pair together an exegesis course with a preaching course. So when you take interpretation of the Gospels and Acts with me, then you'll also take preaching from the Gospels and Acts if you're in the MDiv program. There you have translation components as well as broader exegetical components and study of the interpretation of these books that's then paired together with, and the discussion in that about all of that is meant to flow into, and you write a exegesis paper on a passage. Mm-hmm. And then you preach on that same passage. Exegesis should be the foundation of sermons. Then we think about how sermons and the goal of writing a sermon also informs our exegesis. That there's a real cordial pairing of the two.
It's been neat to see that integration here. There's not a sense that students are able to finish their language classes and then put language on the back burner. We just don't really give them that option here. Because, again, through their whole course of study, as long as they're taking exegesis classes, they're having accountability for their grammar, for their for vocabulary, for translation. And it's really well put together. And there's also something, I think, in our classes about coming together to learn the language. You know, a lot of people will do some prep work on their own, but I think of how many things that I've learned from reading Hebrew in a classroom setting, just in my own studies when I was being taught, and many things I know about the language that I can't actually point to a grammar or to some article that explains it, but I can say, well, I don't know, but this is how you read this. And again, it's not to create sort of just an oral tradition that goes on, but there really is a value to sitting down in a classroom setting as a group and learning in community.
Well, I think that people don't always understand how much using language tools requires discernment. Translation, like I said before, is an act of interpretation. And interpretation isn't done by rote. It's done through wisdom and discernment and experience. And so you learn how to do that wisely alongside of others who have been doing it. And it's just sort of an aspect of the trade, so to speak, something that you get mentored in. Get all the tools you can before you come, to seminary. But then there's still a lot to learn yet about how to use those tools.
Being a pastor involves a lot of things. It involves, shall we say, skill in dealing with people. You also have to know the pattern of sound words, the teaching, that the systematic teaching of the Bible. But one of the chief tools of a pastor's trade is words. Knowing words in their meaning, their denotation, their connotation, enjoying words, creating word pictures appropriate, and learning the languages, even biblical Hebrew, biblical Greek, forces you to keep and enhance your understanding of words and utilizing words. It's not just meeting people for coffee, important as that can be, but it's also working in the Word so that your sermons, faithfully preached, you're crafting messages that use words that you've thought about and you've studied.
Speaking of studying, what these fine professors will be discussing next time here on Roundtable is biblical studies and the focus of instruction here, specifically at Mid-America Reformed Seminary. They'll take up how they handle hermeneutics, biblical theology, and more. All of this next time on Roundtable. I'm Jared Luchabor. Thanks for joining us.